I've lost the name of the French architect of 18 years' experience. He was an important New York architect with a big office. Anyway, he and Mendelssohn designed Japanese and German villages. The story of that, which I'm going to tell, and you probably won't want to use, I put some of it into a talk I gave to open a session year before last at Gaithersburg. It's amazing the enormity of the effort that went into building those things. We decided that the 2-inch thick rice straw mat that characterized the Japanese home, the tatami, were important because they were the major resistance to the bomb passage through one floor after another. So we had to have tatamis. We didn't know whether we could get Japanese ones, so we set up a tatami factory to make rice straw mats 2 inches thick. But Rickards of the Knox Rickards team, who had been involved in setting up factory production of bombs with proper quality control over the filler, on Standard Oil insistence, Rickards went without military orders to Hawaii, and without any evidence convinced Air Force people that he had an important job to get some Japanese tatamis to Indiana. And if the people could get them to the West Coast, he'd get them to Indiana. And unauthorized planes picked up from missions and from Japanese Hawaiian homes a supply of tatamis that were far more than we needed. And they got to the West Coast and then the Dugway. So we had an enormous supply of tatamis. Now, we had about 40 different Japanese apartment buildings. They were three side by side, and at least a dozen. I don't know. We had 18 of those complexes, and each complex was 3 units. The shoji, the sliding screens, and the Fusuma, which were the outdoor sliding screens, the outdoor shutters, had to be made just the way Antonin Raymond was the architect, the Japanese specialist. Raymond had been so particular about these that he wanted hinoki to build them with. Now, hinoki is a Japanese name for a kind of spruce. We couldn't find any hinoki, but we found another spruce on a shipload from Japan on the Pacific, headed for Portland, Oregon. We managed to get that ship to land at San Francisco instead of Portland. This was Standard Oil's doing. I don't know how they did it. They set up and Raymond wanted the cabinet work on making these things under his eye in New Jersey. Now, here we wanted to build a place in Utah. The wood was in the Pacific. The cabinet work was to be in New Jersey. And these are absurdities. But emotions in wartime run high. And Slim Myers was a good salesman. Slim said, damn it, we've got to be absolutely right. these journals are not going to stop us because we didn't have something that was really characteristic. We've got to be right. So we went to these terrific pains of setting up trucks going from the East Coast to the West Coast at a time when you had to have a permit to drive a truck to show that you had the right to use gasoline. So he had Esso people posted at places between here and San Francisco to help. You were to telephone the nearest Esso man who would get in touch with anybody who tried to stop your truck. And so he greased the rails. That may be a reflection of corporate structure. Corporations have learned that, I'm afraid, there are countries where you have to bribe somebody to get the action. And they were ready to bribe anybody to get those trucks to the East Coast. Well, the shojis and fusumas and so on were made in New Jersey and shipped back to Utah. Utah had to build a 5-mile road and a water tower on a hillside to give water pressure and lay piping from there to the village, the Japanese and German village, hose connections at each house and a hose. An amateur fire department available. During the construction, there was an incipient strike by the workers because they were not being served the cupcakes that they saw were being served to the officers on the post. And the solution to that was to serve them cupcakes. The contract, the go-ahead, occurred, it was in a January. And I think it was April when this test started. We had built the houses, laid the road, gotten all these shojis and fusumas, set up a furniture manufacturing operation to manufacture heavy German-type oak furniture in a New York furniture house to have some German furniture. We had found clay on the proving ground, which was a quality adequate to make the tiles for the both the German and the Japanese roofs had to have tiles. The Japanese houses were put together without nails, with wooden pegs the way they're supposed to be. Imagine training American workmen to do this kind of work. We had it ready by spring. And
what year was that?
1943. The summer fall of 42 is when we dropped bombs on Madison. We now were in factory production on bombs and had villages. And it was the late spring of 43. Might have been the early summer. I'm not so sure of that. I could find out. I've got the files that would give the dates. Well, these tests had the old thermite bomb of the chemical core in them. They had the short magnesium bomb, the M50. They had another magnesium bomb that had a steel plate along with a magnesium plate as a striker. And they had the M69, the cloth tail bomb. And it was obvious that these bombs, the tests had to be damn good in order to stand up to the Air Force and the air chemical officer that we were on, that the chemical corps was on the right track in supplying bombs for the Air Force to drop. I was chairman of the team that was had the job of assessing fires. We had a chemical officer show up who reminded me that he had known me as an undergraduate at Indiana University, and I didn't remember him, but he remembered me. One of the things I remember was that he told me that as a person in charge of the section and in charge of this assessment, I didn't dress properly to impress people. I don't know what I was wearing, but it didn't give me a second thought, and I laughed and ignored him. But he had the military viewpoint that you got to not only be good, you got to impress people with the way you look. You ought to look militarily. You look, you're not military. Yeah, all right, you ought to look militarily. I didn't. Our assessment team was a large group. A lot of teams going different parts of the target. And if nothing hit in your target, you move to another place. And if nothing hit there, you move to another one. And finally, you may be converged on something if a fire had got started somewhere. The Norden bomb sight was being used, but it's hard to hit buildings, you know, and an awful lot of the bombs didn't hit much. We had a dugout that was impervious to bombing, and a fire truck, but it didn't dare post itself near enough because sometimes the bombs would be dropped a half mile off target, and if the truck was only a half a mile up the road, that was unsafe. So we early decided that we couldn't wait for the fire truck. We had to rush out to take care of fires. In fact, we had to rush out before all of the bombs had dropped, and we learned to identify these pieces of a cluster, the metal pieces that held a lot of bombs together in a cluster of 100 or so. I don't remember how many in a cluster. You dropped a cluster, and then the cluster was separated explosively, and the pieces that had held it together came down as metal parts, and they were among the things you had to dodge. You not only dodged these bombs with their cloth tails, but you dodged the cluster parts. But we learned to see, well, there are no clusters in there yet. Safe to run over and be closer to the building. And we were always there before the fire department was.
Was this high-altitude bombing or low altitude?
I think it was 5,000 feet. I'm pretty sure it was 5,000 feet bombing. And that we tried a 10,000-footer and didn't get any. We tried 10,000 feet out in the sand dunes and just had no success. We assessed the bombs, decided the thermate was no good, and the chemical corps so bought that a good many months later, when Colonel Adams from the Chemical Corps and I were writing a report, I got him to agree to the statement in the report that all the thermate bombs should be taken out and dropped in the ocean to be sure nobody ever bothered to drop them anywhere. And when a Chemical Corps officer signed his name to that report, why, you know that they believe it. And that was a consequence of the Dugway tests. I shouldn't tell you about my European wartime experience without going back and saying that in the winter of 42-43, Russell and Ray Ewell, the technical aide, I guess he was formerly Earl Stevenson's aide rather than mine, but he worked mostly with me. They went to Europe to try to sell the British Royal Air Force our M69 bomb. But it wasn't yet in good quality control, and there were some defective tests. And although Russell got to be a close buddy to the, oh my, what's the name of the Mount, Lark Mountbatten, the man who was murdered, remember?
Yes, that's right.
Well, Russell, as president of Standard Oil Development Company, got to be friendly with Mountbatten, and had good high connections in England, but he got nowhere on this sales. The tests we had were indifferent. Dugway, we hadn't yet had our villages. So when the next year we had results of two villages, I should say that when the tests were over, there were a number of moot points, and I decided we'd never be in the clear unless we continued the tests. So I went back to Dugway, and told General Kabrick. Bill Kabrick was in charge of Dugway Proving Ground, the Chemical Corps Proving Ground. He and Alden Waite, former head of it, head of the whole Chemical Corps, and many others in the Chemical Corps, had been graduate students of a course that we ran for Chemical Corps people who wanted a master's degree in chemical engineering for their Chemical Corps work. So we knew a number of these people, and Kabrick had been one of them. Well, he was a general in charge of the arsenal, and he told me that, well, the tests are over, and I said, General Kabrick, they're not, they can't, they mustn't be over. This is not, our evidence is ambiguous, and we'll be in trouble sooner or later if we don't run more tests. We've got to have more. He argued against it. He had an executive officer, Ed Baker, who later went back with Conoco and became an important man in Continental Oil Company. And Ed Baker was technically a lot brighter than Kabrick. And but for Baker's support in this conversation that I had with Kabrick, I never would have won my battle. But Kabrick finally agreed that we had to do some more testing. So we opened up Dugway and did a second round of tests and got the clear picture that the M69 was the best bomb we had. This was early fall, and by this time we had decided we needed to go to the British again, and this time I was to go, and I was not only to take the story on fire warfare to them and learn something about their work on flamethrowers, but I was to tell them the oxygen story. and I still can't remember the name of the head of the oxygen subdivision. It begins with R. Now, it'll hit me sooner or later. Anyway, I was to tell that the oxygen story. That was the story of Fred Key's work on an oxygen generator, a liquid oxygen generator, and of... I hit another mental blank. A man who... Irish name, physical chemist, quarrel with Keyes, left them and went with a mechanical engineering department, had built a gas-producing oxygen generator using the cloud engine, cloud cycle, rather than the, what's the expansion cycle that you use to get cooling? I get the damnedest blocks on the names.
We can always add the names later.
What?
We can always add the names.
Well, any thermodynamicist knows what happens when you expand something through a...
The Joule-Thomson?
Joule-Thomson, sure. The Joule-Thomson effect was used for oxygen production. Well, the cloud cycle is a more efficient thing, and Sam Collins is the name of the man I didn't have.
Okay.
I now have Joule-Thomson and Sam Collins. I went for 2 days unable to think of the name rhubarb. I could visualize the vegetable, but I couldn't think of the name. Well, these blocks are strange things. Fortunately, they don't happen too often. Sam Collins had made a beautiful, small, continuous producer of oxygen. So you might consider carrying an oxygen factory in your airplane to make oxygen. Or you might consider some high-pressure cylinders or liquid oxygen. Or in a submarine, you might take along Collins's producer if you had a snorkel to get air from the surface. Anyway, I had quite an oxygen story to tell, and the British had an oxygen story. So I went to England in the late... My gosh, it was November, October or November of 43, to tell them out about bombs. Boy, this has got nothing to do with chemical engineering. It's an interesting wartime story. Should I go ahead?
Oh, yes.
With
no,
it?
I think we should have it.
Well, I met important people in connection with it. My assistant in London, personally under me, believe it or not, was Joel Hildebrand of the Hildebrand Function. Joel had been in the U.S. Chemical Research Laboratory in Paris in World War I. And one of the Huxleys was in the act. And Joel was an important man at Berkeley, an important physical chemist. And come World War II, he made himself available. And I guess he got a lower job than he'd expected to get. By the time he applied, there was no high job, and so he got to be my London representative on fire warfare. And his job was to write a report, preferably every week, on the research going on in England that was related to fire warfare of any sort. His predecessor had been Geoffrey Broughton, who got his doctorate with us. Geoffrey later became head of chem engineering at a college, a textile college north of Boston. I can't remember the name. Lowell Institute.
Lowell Institute.
And from there, he became head of chemical engineering at the University of Rochester. So Jeffrey Broughton was an able guy. As my technical aide in London, Jeffrey sent me single-spaced, three-page letters about everything that went on. But he didn't try to get into high places or tell anybody how to act. I'm going to have to cut some of this out. Joel Hildebrand didn't enjoy reporting on the details, and I never got reports from him that amounted to anything. But he knew all the top generals in the Air Force and the Army and the admirals first names with some of them, and didn't hesitate to hold forth on what British policies should be about this, that, or the other. I got to take all of this out of this. This mustn't go down.
Don't worry about that later.
But Joel was an awfully interesting guy, a charmer. He had a book. If he was a little hard on stories, he'd get out his book to remind him of one of the stories he was going to tell. And if there was a really good one, he didn't know it went in his book. And I don't know which volume he had in his pocket. Well, Hildebrand was the man who had set up my meeting in England. And he was a better setter up of meetings than Broughton would have been, because he knew more important people. I got buddy-buddy with Sir Donald Banks, who was head of the petroleum warfare in England. I've forgotten some of the other names, but many with a knighthood. One in the Lord area, and I've forgotten those. Anyway, when I arrived in England, I found that on the day of my arrival, on the late afternoon of the day of my arrival, I was scheduled to talk before the Zoroastrian Society, which was a British collection of fire marshals, who were the older people, too old to be in the army, but they were out as fire marshals. Group captains from the Air Force, professors, mathematicians, every kind of person, named after the Persian Zoroastrians, who were religious fire worshippers. And the Zoroastrian Society talked about how better to put out fires, or how to do this, that, or the other. It passed on the quality of bombs. It got its finger into everything. And the head of it, the president of the Zoroastrian Society, was Finch, G.I. Finch, later president of the Royal Society, and then head of industrial chemistry under Sir Alfred Edgerton. Edgerton was head of chemical engineering and fuel technology, and Finch was under him, and I was to see much of Edgerton, but this first meeting was to be with Finch's crowd, the Zoroastrian Society. I did not at that time know what kind of a guy Finch was. Finch's assistant was a guy named Penny, who in later years became Britain's number one Man in nuclear energy, and Lord Penny. He is today Lord Penny, a very important man in British physics.